Investors Chronicle.
On the Companies and Markets Show this week, our result of the week is Wizz Air. Madeline Taylor joins us to talk through that. We also touch on some of the airline chaos from the last week or so. And then Christopher Akers is on hand to talk through his feature this week, Food Unchained. A lot of gloom around food companies recently, but should investors be taking the long view? All that and more, let's get into it. Companies and Market Show, welcome back. It is Thursday, the 9th of June, as we speak, back after a week off following the Jubilee weekend. I say back, our host, Dan Jones, he's still away. So in lieu of him, we have Alex Newman. Hi, Alex.
Hi, John. How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. What's coming up on the show today?
We've got airlines, Wizz Air. It's our result of the week. Yeah, we're going to be talking with Maddie and Chris about airline chaos. And we're also going to be speaking with Chris about his excellent food feature.
Yes, as you say, we're also joined by Christopher Akers. Hi, Chris.
Hi, John.
And Madeline Taylor.
Hello. It's good to be here.
Lovely stuff. Right, before we get going properly, a quick news roundup from the week so far. Thursday morning, the FT have reported that the UK chemist chain Boots has been subject to a bid. Apollo Global Management and Mukesh Ambani's Reliance Industries have teamed up with an offer that values the company at between £5 and £6 billion. Elsewhere, staff shortages have led to chaotic scenes at UK airports for more than a week as operators struggle to deal with soaring demand for air travel. After laying off workers during the pandemic, airline operators are now struggling to plug that gap. British Airways told the IC that they're in the biggest recruitment drive in their history. The recent chaos, however, has not dampened the budget travel sector recovery in terms of passenger numbers. Wizz Air this week reported a 390% surge from the previous year. As Alex says, we'll be talking Wizz Air and all things aviation in a moment. JD Sports is setting aside £2 million to cover fines from the Competition and Markets Authority after the watchdog provisionally found it guilty of illegal price fixing over football merchandise. The CMA alleges that JD Sport colluded with football club Rangers FC and the maker of its branded merchandise, Elite Sports, to fix prices in 2018. A couple of weeks ago, we told you that fashion retailer Ted Baker's sale to private equity had moved a step closer. On Tuesday, however, it emerged the sale is now somewhat back on ice as the, quote, preferred bidder withdrew their offer. Share price fell 19% on the news. City Pub Group have said that recent like-for-like sales were ahead of pre-pandemic levels and it received a major boost from the Jubilee holiday period. Sales, quote, continue to strengthen faster than predicted, the premium pub owner said. And finally, the London-listed private hospitals group Mediclinic has rejected a £3.4 billion cash offer from a consortium made up of Remgro, its largest shareholder, and the shipping company MSC. Mediclinic says the offer significantly undervalued the company.
Okay, this week we begin in the skies, or more likely stuck in a queue in Gatwick South Terminal with the airlines, which, like their customers, have been having a pretty miserable time of late. And we're going to start with the carrier whose shares have been in sharpest freefall. That's Wizz Air. Maddie, you cover their results this week for the period for the 12 months to the 31st of March. What happened?
So it really confirmed what we've been seeing from the travel sector generally, which is that demand has come absolutely roaring back. But unfortunately, it's profits that are the question. Because, I mean, you've got, on the one hand, rising fuel prices. There's a problem with staff shortages, both from the airlines and the airports. And now you've got, you know, issues creeping in about consumer demand, which might even start to flag as the year goes on. So Wizz Air has really been kind of the most dramatic example of this that we've seen yet. So they nearly tripled their passenger numbers that they were flying to about 27 million in the year ending in March. But at the same time, profits sunk, you know, even deeper into the red, making a loss of 642 million euros.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty staggering looking at the figures. I mean, the comparisons, we're still in a bit of a pandemic hangover, aren't we? So I suppose the 2021 full year figures there would have captured all of the lockdowns, all of the total shutdown of the European airline industry. So no surprise that, I mean, tripling sounds amazing, doesn't it? But those are compared to some miserable figures. What's behind that horrible loss for a second year in a row, though?
It's a real tangle of various problems that have all hit at once. So, I mean, one thing you've got to remember is that airlines are just a notoriously low margin business, even at the best of times. So any one of these problems happening on their own could be a huge issue just in and of itself. So you've also seen staffing become an issue just across the board. You even had EasyJet saying, I think this is quite a good encapsulation of the problem. EasyJet has said that on their smallest aircrafts, they're cutting out the back row of just 6 seats in order to make it so that they have to have one fewer member of the cabin crew actually on the plane at the time, which I think points to the measures that they're having to take to cut costs are quite considerable at this point. So staffing has been an issue. That's one of the things. But then you've also got this concurrent problem with the fuel prices. And that's really hit Wizz Air because unlike any of the other airlines, they were completely unhedged for their jet fuel prices when the crisis first started in Ukraine, which obviously kicked up fuel prices massively.
Yeah, and I suppose oil was already rising ahead of the Russia's invasion, wasn't it? So they've had that whole 12 months with prices creeping up. Have they done anything to change their, you know, their pretty bold hedging strategy? Are they still flying kind of blind into whatever is going to happen in commodity markets?
So yes, they have had to row back on that. Right. So management first cut out their hedging right after the onset of the coronavirus pandemic, which obviously made demand for air travel quite uncertain. And you could sort of see the rationale partially at the time. In March, they started some partial hedging for the current year, but that only extends until August. So they, I think they said they're 30% hedged until August and then nothing beyond that, which could obviously continue to be a massive issue for them, you know, because nobody can really predict when the current commodity prices are going to come back down.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? It's like hedging strategy or no hedging strategy until it gets bad, and then you have a hedging strategy. But I'm imagining those options that they're buying are getting pretty expensive. Presumably for your shareholder, that's one thing you're really keen to see in the next couple of months is if it can extend that hedging, because it looks so volatile at the moment that it's just going to blow this year's results out again, isn't it, potentially?
Certainly. I mean, and when you look at the other airlines, none of them were quite that bold. You know, Wizz Air is notably in the worst position in terms of hedging compared to Ryanair or EasyJet and any of the other low-cost budget airlines.
Yeah. And so, I mean, at the same time, they've had this, and they're still talking about it this week, weren't they? They're a real expansion strategy. And I remember in the pandemic, it was one of the stories which really caught my eye. I think it was in the second lockdown or so, they issued a 500 million euro bond at a sort of 1.3% coupon, just like astonishingly cheap debt for such a wobbly industry. And then they did it again the start of this year, I think even cheaper bond issuance. So they've had this very cheap cost of capital to expand. But I mean, the kind of headwinds they're facing now are likely to check that, or is it still full steam ahead into, you know, the Middle East and elsewhere?
Yeah, so it's been a real selling point for them to investors is that they're seen as the growthiest out of all these budget airlines. As you say, they've really been pursuing quite an ambitious expansion policy, and they haven't shown any signs that that's letting up yet. So they're planning to expand their capacity by 40% compared to pre-pandemic. And that includes growing their fleet from, I think, 153 to 182 aircraft. And at the same time, they're pursuing opening a new airline in Malta and then potentially also expanding to Saudi Arabia. So they're really not showing any signs that they're slowing down on that front. But as you say, there are huge questions about how they're going to be able to fund this. Not just them, but sort of any business that is mostly debt fueled in terms of their growth. The outlook is much worse for them now.
Yeah, it's so interesting, is it? I mean, just in the space of a couple of years, I remember that their hubs were in the East Europe, so they had this lower cost when it came to labor and just operating overheads. And then at the same time, they had debt, but it wasn't extreme leverage like some of the competitors in Europe. But this seems to have completely reversed. They're going into what looks like pricier markets, presumably for operating costs. And then, yeah, at the same time, their leverage is expanding rapidly. That, you know, the more they lose as well.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And I mean, yes, they are noticeable for having this focus on the east. That's still part of their policy, is that they want to expand further into Eastern Europe and into the Middle East. And I have heard some talk that this might help them, that one of the rationales for this is that it might help them to avoid some of the seasonality that comes with airlines. So expanding into territories that may not have such a noticeable impact of the summer being much busier than the rest of the year. So it might lead them to have a more stable pattern of sales. But I think that's pretty much all speculation at this point, really.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one place where sales are neither stable nor growing, because they've disappeared, is Ukraine. They had some routes operating out of Kiev and Lviv there. What's the status now? Did they update this week on what's going on?
Yes, so Ukraine really was one of their target markets, obviously, before what happened. And so they were actively operating out of there. So they had to suspend and cancel a lot of their flights and routes, obviously, from February onwards. But they do still have 4 aircraft that are stranded there, and they're hoping to repatriate, but there hasn't really been much progress that they've reported yet. And, you know, they have those aircraft have a book value of about 25 million euros. So it is quite a lot riding on it.
Right. Okay. I mean, it sounds like a mess, really. I mean, we've moved to a hold. It seems like that the feeling there is it's a pretty nervy hold, given all their challenges. Is that sort of fair assessment of your take on the results, Maddie?
Yeah, so I mean, I think it's just very difficult to see what's going to happen. I think that's really what investors are reacting to. So like EasyJet and Ryanair before them, they haven't given any real guidance for the full year, the next full year results, but they have said that they expect that they're going to keep operating at a loss over the summer, which is quite a considerable blow, because the summer is usually the busiest season for airlines. So a lot of it is going to hinge really on the consumer outlook as well, that we haven't really talked about. Obviously, with costs of living going up, there is some doubt over whether this travel boom is going to be sustained into the long term. And at the moment, Wizz Air is noting that they're seeing quite positive bookings growth, and they also plan to hike their prices. But obviously, price hikes are slightly contentious in that kind of negative consumer environment. So it could help, or it could drive people away from travel completely. Yep. So I think it's really that investors are looking for more certainty than is really on offer here.
Really interesting. I mean, the one thing that I can imagine might put consumers off has been recent headlines. And Chris, if I could bring you in, I mean, you wrote a story on this subject for this week, and it'd probably be a bit familiar to anyone who's been following the mainstream news. For those listeners who might need catching up, what's been going on in UK airports at the moment?
Yes. So as Manny mentioned, airports and airlines are really struggling to recruit enough staff at the moment to deal with soaring post-pandemic demand after they let workers go during COVID. So for example, British Airways let go around 10,000 workers over the course of the pandemic, and now they're struggling to recruit them back. The industry says that the government didn't give them enough warning about the end of travel restrictions, but the Transport Secretary, Grant Shapps, has come out recently to blame operators for not being prepared enough before the end of restrictions. And he's also said the government won't listen to visa rules to let more European workers in to help with the problem. And this lack of staff is why we saw such crazy scenes at airports over the Jubilee weekend and the half-term break, with short-term cancellations, lots of delays. There was even a report of pilots having to help load bags onto planes. So it's a chaotic situation at the moment.
Yes, I mean, it's kind of amazing. I have to say I didn't have the notion that airlines were operationally run so thinly that we could, you know, they hit a crunch, or they overpromise, and then they're having to cancel flights. You would have thought, wouldn't you, that they kind of put the staffing in place well ahead of agreeing to service the routes. Is this, I mean, if this is a problem now, surely it's going to persist through the summer as well.
Yeah, I mean, there are conflicting views on this. So
Right.
a couple of analysts I've sort of spoken to have said they expect things to improve by the summer. But then a couple of days ago, the head of Heathrow Airport came out and said he thinks it'll take sort of 12 to 18 months to improve. So it's going to be a long-term issue by the sounds of it. One of the problems is it takes quite a lot of time to actually train and hire new staff, given security problems at airports and background checks, etc. So it's not a quick fix.
Maddie, did Wizz Air have much to say about what's been going on in the last couple of weeks in the UK, or is it given their focus, they're slightly less impacted by what's been happening on this island?
They've been no exception to that general trend that Chris just mentioned. I mean, they've had to cancel a number of flights, and including all of their flights from June onwards from Doncaster Airport. And the other two airports that they operate out of, Luton and Gatwick, have been two of the worst hit by the cancellations.
Right.
So they're definitely experiencing it. However, they did take pains to note that their staffing levels have actually gone up from, I think, 4,000 to about 6,700 now. That's compared with pre-pandemic levels. And they say that they're staffed fully for a normal environment, which I think is their way of saying that they think it's the airports that are at fault here, not the airlines. So they mentioned a lack of air traffic controllers and security staff at the airports.
Wow. So, I mean, lots of mudslinging then. So, some blaming politicians, others blaming the airports themselves. I mean, for investors, I suppose the question here is the promised rebound post-pandemic dead already? I mean, we saw, Chris, I don't know if you thoughts on this as well. I mean, the flights have recovered, according to Eurocontrol, to about 85% of 2019 levels. I mean, it's just that long list of headwinds facing the sector mean that you're either going to have disgruntled customers now, or just that, you know, we're going to have failures within the airline market.
I think it's fair to say it's quite a mixed picture. So I spoke to
Right.
BA this week for a news article I wrote, and they were saying that they're getting lots of headlines, obviously, about flight cancellations, but BA had pre-planned all of their cancellations. So there's a bit of a different situation for them compared to the budget operators. And as we've been discussing, demand is rebounding well after the pandemic. I think the key issue is how airlines go about dealing with that demand. They're obviously struggling with that at the moment. As you say, lots of disgruntled customers. Maddie mentioned summer trading is going to be quite poor for some of the operators as well. So I think in the short term, clearly lots of volatility. It's just a very unclear picture. So it's a difficult one for investors. I think that is reflected in why we sort of moved to hold with Wizz.
I don't think I had the worst experience, but it was actually at Gatwick. I think so many flights had been delayed that the airport, I went there in the evening, that essentially there was no food left in the airport. It was a
Wow.
sort of post-apocalyptic vision. You were stumbling around because everybody whose flights had been delayed had clearly had the same idea of, let's go and get a meal while we're waiting for our flight. And the result was that the only hot food you could find was from one pret-a-manger, who seemed to just have endless stores of the mozzarella and tomato croissant. So you could see people, gradually realizing that this was the one bit of hot food, and it was a pipeline into pret-a-manger, their finest hour.
Yeah. There's always Pret, isn't there? I suppose holding the can for everyone else. The city dies, airlines die. There's always going to be Prets. Brilliant. Well, thanks so much for discussing the airline chaos with us. I'm sure we'll be following the travails of the companies in the sector over the coming months and the summer. Okay, then. Well, to finish, I'd like to bring back Chris, who wrote this week's excellent cover feature, which is on food, or more specifically, the Food Unchained: How to Tuck Into the Transformation of the Nutrition Industry, as it reads on the cover. Also on the cover, we've got pictures of a basket of vegetables, a cow, a piglet, and some grains shimmering in the breeze, but also what looks like, Chris, a burger in a petri dish, some lab-coated technicians in a warehouse, and a robotic arm tending to a vertical farm. Chris, I mean, food's been in the news an awful lot recently. I mean, in the UK, I mean, all the focus is on prices rising and supply chain chaos, and that's reflected globally as well, though on a somewhat more frightening scale with a looming food insecurity and hunger crisis exacerbated by the invasion of Ukraine. But you argue in the piece that investors should take a longer view on the sector. I mean, why are you optimistic?
Yes. So as the images on the cover suggest, there's a lot of exciting technological progress being made, I would argue, in the background of the food sector, which I think quite a lot of people and investors probably aren't really aware of. My feature sort of focuses on meat alternatives, which we'll come to. And I think this could drive growth over the next few decades for companies which are getting involved in this area. Meat alternatives are becoming more attractive to consumers for a host of reasons, but I would argue they also have the potential to help societies reduce the environmental impacts associated with traditional meat production and agriculture, as well as meeting growing global food demand as the global population increases. So there's lots of potential.
I suppose that kind of win-win-win was one of the reasons why Beyond Meat both became the poster child for this when it listed a couple of years ago, but it's also, it kind of encapsulated lots of these themes into one stock almost, and it was enormously successful on its debut. I mean, it's fair to say that after plenty of initial excitement, the air has gone out of the story, or rather maybe the beetroot juice has sort of bled out of the imitation burger. But what's happened there with the Beyond Meat story? Is this a question of execution gone wrong, or is it stalling in the consumer appetite for meat substitutes?
So yeah, as you mentioned, Beyond Meat is a key player in the plant-based meat sector. It had a huge IPO in 2019, but yeah, the shares have fallen back by over 60% since then. It's a pretty disastrous performance. I think there are a couple of things going on with Beyond Meat. One is there was a lot of hype at the time. It's at the forefront of this new technology with plant-based meats. But yes, growth has fallen back a bit. I mentioned in the future, US sales of plant-based meats were flat in 2021, and that disappointed the market. There's also the argument that the company has sort of put all its eggs in one basket by focusing just on one product with plant-based meats, no diversification. But I think a counter-argument to that would be that we are still in the very early stages of the meat alternatives revolution. And I think, I mean, I've spoken to analysts who would argue that this is still quite a solid long-term investment option and still very early days, as I said.
Yeah, I suppose, you know, their IPO was a mark of that promise, because, you know, they still are, at least at the end of last year, loss-making, you know, 2 years into their life as a public company. So the fact that they were able to raise so much money then, and, you know, trying to push into the American food market is no easy task.
It's almost too much too soon, I think, with that
sure,
company.
Yeah.
And a big IPO, the valuation was quite lofty. Again, that it's still the short term. Looking further ahead, so it could have a good path ahead of it, Beyond Meat.
And I suppose without having to get into the, you know, the loss making, super highly valued, speculative end of the sector. I mean, you single out a number of companies in the piece, you know, Unilever, Treat, Cranswick, just a few of them, which are or have pivoted somewhat towards plant-based products, and sales there have been growing rapidly. I mean, to me, this diversification, if consumer tastes in the West particularly are changing, makes a lot of sense. For investors, I suppose it does come down to the bottom line as well, though, doesn't it? Not just what's driving or changing the mix at the top line. So is there a margin benefit here to, you know, if you're a Cranswick, to actually be pushing away from dairy and pork and going down the Mediterranean foods business, which they have done in the last year?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think so far the margin picture is quite mixed. I think it's important to say that for a lot of these companies, they've only recently got into plant-based foods and meat alternatives. So it might take a couple of years to see what the margin picture is like, I mean, going back to Beyond Meat's, its margins have sort of struggled recently, which doesn't paint a great picture. I think it's an important point to make here that meat's alternatives tend to be more expensive as well for consumers, which obviously factors into the margin conversation. But it sort of industry figures I've spoken to argue that they are aiming to bring costs down to sort of parity with traditional meat products over the next few years, and that will obviously benefit demand. So that was a bit of a sidetrack, but I think the evidence on margins will become clearer over time. We are dealing with sort of new technologies, new products, so it'll take some time to get a clearer picture, I think.
Yeah, I suppose pork or chicken doesn't need a massive marketing budget. It's quite a well-established product, isn't it? Compared to, you know, the competitors now emerging.
On diversification, I think it is important to note that lots of these companies are diversifying. It is obvious that they're seeing the importance of trends around plant-based meats. Younger people, for example, are more likely to be eating meats only occasionally or not eating meats at all. And wealthier countries in the West are consuming less meat, even while global consumption rises, and companies are recognizing that. So I spoke to Devro for the piece, and they make casings for sausages, and they said popularity of veggie sausages is increasing, and for that reason they're examining ways to use their casings in non-meat products. So yeah, good example of a company recognizing what's happening in the market and slightly changing tack.
Veggie sausages, of course, now in the Bank of England's inflation basket calculations. So just underlines the growth of that product. You talked a little bit about, I suppose, the margin picture evolving over time. The holy grail, when I suppose people are talking about long-term trends with meat, of course, is what's going to happen with cultured meat or lab-grown meat. Okay, we might be talking about some years hence now, but I suppose the huge promise here is if it can be scaled almost in a lab, you reduce all the enormous costs of input pricing, the vagaries of crop markets, et cetera, et cetera. The other question for investors, though, I mean, is how far away is all of this before it becomes part of the mainstream food industry? And are there any ways in right now?
Yeah, so I think it's important to understand, first of all, what we actually mean by cultured meat. So cultured meats or lab-grown meats is where meats is produced using a tissue sample from a real animal, and the cells are then grown in a bioreactor. And the idea is that the end product is the real deal. So that, yeah, the technology is making progress. There are a couple of ways in for investors at the moment in the UK. A company called Agronomics, which the IC's written about before, and Agronomics focuses on cultured meats companies that has several investments in companies in the space. Another option that's just listed in London recently is called BSF Enterprise. Quite a small company, but it's aiming to produce the UK's first 100% lab-grown meats in the next 12 months. So that demonstrates that progress is being made in this area. But yeah, options are quite limited at the moment for investors in terms of listed companies, but things are emerging. And I think over the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years, that will accelerate and more opportunities will emerge along with that.
Yeah, you certainly feel the first big player to get on board with that. Though I imagine even that, you know, the Tyson Foods, you know, meat mega companies out there are paying very, very close attention to the potential wholesale disruption of their of their business models. But no, that's fascinating, Chris. There's obviously plenty to chew over there. And you can read much more about the companies Chris highlights in this week's cover story, which again is Food Unchained. That's out on the 10th of June from all good purveyors of weekly investment magazines.
The Companies and Markets show this week was hosted by Alex Newman and edited and produced by me, John Rogers. And for Maddie's write-up of Wizz Air or Chris's long read on food, head on over to the Investors Chronicle website or find it in the latest edition of our magazine. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.